On the program today, commodities and the global economics thereof, how all business, like politics, really is local, and what exactly does a data scientist do all day anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 12th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. A word as we get going today about raw materials. The word is commodities, that from which all else is made. For our purposes today, stuff that is pulled out of the ground. We start here because the price of copper and coal, aluminum, and even gold and other commodities is down a whole lot. Copper's been trading at six-year lows this week, just for instance, all of which has some of the big mining companies out there talking about dividends, suspending their dividends, that is. Companies like Glencore and Anglo American and BHP Billiton had hoped that by investing billions of dollars to diversify their businesses across multiple metals and various fuels, they could keep on pumping and mining to keep up their cash flow. That, however, is not happening, as Marketplace's Andy Euler starts us off in this story of a global economy.
Everybody blames it on China, which by some measures is fair. That country drives about 40% of the world's copper demand, and a downturn in its economy means it's building fewer skyscrapers. But what about the other emerging markets, say India? Bilge Atan teaches economics at Northeastern University.
We know the manufacturing sector is booming in India, but India is nowhere near a major consumer of commodities to the extent that China has become.
But it's not just copper. Coal is at a 12-year low. Around 70% of Chinese coal miners operate at a loss, but they're still operating. The big guys aren't getting that piece of the dwindling pie, so they're investing in other commodities, BHP in oil and gas, Anglo American in iron ore. Glencore's biggest investments are still in copper and coal, but it has a lot of agriculture commodities. Michael Greenberger says diversification in commodities might not be the right bet. He teaches law at the University of Maryland.
So what we've seen over the years is the commodities are rolling in sync, and now they're rolling in sync toward a supply-demand price. So you can't hedge because there's not going to be any commodity that's going to do better than the rest. They're all moving in sync.
In other words, the Glencores are running out of places to move resources in order to hit pay dirt. As a result, they're cutting costs, shutting mines, getting rid of debt, and suspending dividends. Bad news for investors. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's another commodity not doing so hot. Oil, specifically the West Texas benchmark, hit $41 a barrel on the way down today, off just a hair shy of 3%. I saw an analyst this morning saying the crude, he thinks, is going to hit $30 a barrel, before it's going to hit $50 again. So think about that, just in terms of global demand. All right, meanwhile, IAC, Interactive Corporation, is after Angie's List. IAC has put in a hostile bid of more than $500 million for the website, where consumers pay to read reviews of service providers like roofers and plumbers and painters and all those. Amazon and Google are also trying to get into that space. Amazon with its new home services website, Google offering a special online advertising deal to service providers. Sally Herships has more now on why the home services landscape is getting a renovation.
It may seem hard to believe, but not all businesses that advertise put their ads on the internet. Rohit Kulkarni is an internet analyst with RBC. He says many small businesses still promote themselves like it is the 1980s.
On local TV, on local radio, direct mail.
Even in the yellow pages. Remember those? Kulkarni says this means if you're in the business of e-commerce or online advertising, you see those local ads as a huge untapped market.
You have anywhere between $100 to $150 billion spent by these small local businesses on local advertising.
Which is why IAC, Amazon, and Google are moving into the home services space. Google is testing a new ad service for electricians, contractors, and handymen who do those special jobs around the house that you can't. And Amazon has a new home services website.
If you're looking to buy some plumbing material on Amazon, you might also want a plumber.
Neil Doshi is a research analyst with Mizuho Securities. He says Amazon is also offering a new feature for consumers, guaranteeing the service. And that's different than just reading a review on Angie's List or Yelp.
So if you're not happy with it, then you don't have to pay for it.
which is good for consumers, of course. But for small businesses, reaching the hundreds of millions of customers that Amazon and Google have access to may pay off big time. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Traders threw in the towel early. Today, all three major indices ended in the red as a couple of members of the Fed's interest rate setting committee made some public noises about a rate hike in December. And you know how Wall Street feels about rate hikes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The first big public and private sector strikes in a year hit Athens, Greece today. Tear gas from police, Molotov cocktails from the protesters right smack in the middle of the city. It's been 5 years since that country's debt crisis began. But these protests, after a period this summer when it looked like everything was pretty much fixed or on its way to being fixed, is raising some questions about whether the Greek debt crisis ever really went away. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has this update.
Today's strike was probably unique. This must have been the first time ever that a ruling party has supported a protest against its own policies. That's right, Syriza actually encouraged the walkout, says Raoul Ruperel of the Open Europe think tank.
It's a very strange and surreal situation, and it highlights the schizophrenic nature of Syriza and how it is struggling with its transition from an anti-austerity party to the party of government that is enacting these reforms.
Syriza grudgingly agreed during the summer to enact a whole raft of reforms and budget cuts, this in return for a third bailout from its European partners. But as Hugo Dixon, an economics commentator with the Reuters news agency, points out, many Syriza lawmakers could rebel.
The government could lose its very slender majority. It's only got a majority of 5 seats. In the Greek House of Parliament. And we've got quite a lot of difficult measures that they've got to pass.
The most difficult at the moment is a new law that would help banks repossess homes from defaulting homeowners. There are tax increases, pension cuts, and many other painful reforms. Michael R.E. Rue of the Cardiff Business School sees big trouble ahead.
All the ingredients for a major political and economic crisis are there.
Syriza apparently urged people to join today's strike in the hope it would persuade Greece's European creditors to soften their demands. R.E. Rue doesn't think it's going to happen.
Those governments know that if they have softened Greece, they will face a backlash from their public opinion back home.
Today, amid all the gloom, Greece got some good news. Unemployment is down to its lowest level in 3 years. But don't expect wild rejoicing. It's down to 24.6%. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The shop local movement has been around for a while now. The idea that consumers ought to support hometown businesses. Everything from local produce at farmers markets to the small shops right around the corner. The little guys, in other words. Well, it seems the big guys want to feel more local, too. For Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, the story starts with a trip to McDonald's in Hawaii.
Aloha. Welcome to McDonald's. Would you like to try an extra value meal today with a McCafe?
Hi, I'd like your breakfast sandwich with Spam, please.
Words I never thought I would say. It's actually a breakfast platter with rice and eggs. McDonald's in Hawaii started serving Spam more than 10 years ago because people here really do like it. As the story goes, they acquired a taste for it during World War II. Melanie Okazaki is the marketing manager of McDonald's Hawaii.
We're part of McDonald's Corporation, big global company, but we also do consider our local identity very important.
In recent years, the rest of McDonald's has also made a push to regionalize their menus. For example, serving lobster rolls at some locations in the Northeast.
You know, it's funny, we've kind of almost come full circle.
Denise Lee Yan is a brand consultant for restaurants and retail stores. She says, first, we moved from mom-and-pop stores to bigger national chains. And for a while, the trend at those chains was to standardize everything across all stores. McDonald's used to be a prime example of that. But in recent years, more companies have started to loosen up.
It's so commonplace to have these national or international brands, and it's almost a negative when a company that large acts like a large company. You know, people feel like they are faceless, they don't care about their customers, and we're interested in making a profit as opposed to really doing good things for the community.
So whether it's sourcing local products at Whole Foods, ingredients and decor at Shake Shack, or using local yoga teachers for marketing at Lululemon, Jan says big companies want to feel smaller for their customers. Just this summer, Target started rolling out a line of city-specific products called Local Pride. It's in Boston, San Diego, and Chicago, with more cities to come. Fashion designer Todd Snyder spent time in each place to come up with ideas.
For example, with our Boston series, the Wicked Smart is our number one seller.
That's a t-shirt that says Wicked Smart, S-M-A-H-T. Other shirts highlight local businesses.
We did Legal Seafoods, the Atomic Cafe, Tasty Burger. Yeah, so we have some really good ones. These are all local places.
He says he tried to make it feel like Target was in the know in each city.
And I think connecting with a customer and making them feel like, wow, I can't believe Target has something like this. Because, you know, Target's huge. You kind of feel like, oh, I get it. They get me.
Target declined to discuss the additional costs of these local lines. Barbara Kahn, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, says each company will have to look at sales to see if this works with customers, if the extra costs are worth it.
But I do think that part of what retailers are looking for is to make shopping fun again. I think people feel this ennui. It's the same retail in Paris as it is in New York. It's a little disappointing. It's something about upping the shopping experience, creating curiosity.
Getting people to come into stores, no matter how big they are. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Spock is on the bridge. He's not in some way back office. So in the modern boardroom or in policy conversations, why isn't there a Spock in the room?
Why indeed? Data science straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. No, the Dow's off 254 points. You don't get the wah-wah trombones? What kind of world are we living in? Blue chips off 1.4%, closed at 17,448. The NASDAQ subtracted 61 points, 1.2%, finished at 5,005. The S&P 500 gave back 29 points, 1.4%, ended at 2,045. I've got a little cold. Give me a break. Commodities and energy stocks weighed down the market today. Copper prices hit a six-year low, as we told you earlier. Mining company Glencore dropped 7.6%. Copper producer Freeport-McMoRan off nearly 6%. Today, Chevron dropped almost 2.5%. Bright spot for retailers today after Macy's earnings missed the mark yesterday. Kohl's announced better-than-expected profits, crediting a strong back-to-school season. The stock showed up nearly 6%. Nordstrom up 1.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.31%. Think about that for a minute. Fell to 2.31% after where we've been. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's not like I'm going out on a limb with what I'm about to say here, but someday, and maybe someday soon, actually, real cash money is going to be but a distant memory. It's all going to be ones and zeros and digital payments and Bitcoin and stuff like that. Today's example, the Wall Street Journal reports that Apple is getting into the peer-to-peer payment business, moving money around with a swipe and a tap on your phone. Apple is said to be in talks with banks about adding that feature to its payment platform known as Apple Pay. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports there is good money to be made in replacing the old-fashioned ways that we pay.
An army of companies is lusting over your wallet.
The major banks, Venmo, Google, PayPal, Square.
Brian Yeager is with eMarketer. They're all trying to move your wallet from your pocket to your phone or computer. The thing about wallets is that you can open them and give money to people. The ability to do that electronically has been around for a while, but it is on fire right now.
69 million U.S. adults will use mobile peer-to-peer payments in 2015. That's a third of mobile device owners.
That's going to likely double by 2020. Venmo payment volume almost tripled in the past year, from $700 million to almost $2 billion a quarter. For consumers, the draw is obvious.
There are frequently no fees attached to it.
Colin Gillis is director of research at BGC Financial. So if it's free half the time, why are companies so drawn in? Because the real goal of peer-to-peer money transfers isn't fees, it's
to bring people into the platform.
That is, if you can use your iPhone to pay your friend, you'll stick around to use it to pay for music or pay for groceries. Whatever you're doing, you'll be using Apple or Google or Venmo or Facebook, or you get the idea.
The second thing that matters in mobile is data.
Julie Osk is vice president at Forrester Research.
And P2P payments, wallets, any kind of payments give us a lot of insights into who our friends are, who we spend time with, where we spend our money.
And these days, data is money. Apple, though it focuses less on data, will be well-positioned if it enters this space. It already has 800 million iTunes accounts with cards on file. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
A study not too long ago by the Kaiser Family Foundation showed that nearly half of all employees who get insurance through work are now paying deductibles of $1,000 a year or more. That means more of us are paying for prescription drugs out of our own pockets, something that has escaped the notice of neither the public, nor politicians, nor businesses in the healthcare sector. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains that a growing number of companies believe they have found a way to spend less.
We've entered a world where the next time your doctor prescribes a new medication, you could whip out your smartphone and find the cheapest price in town.
So, Arthur, what I wanted to show is kind of the most basic search functionality out there today.
Okay, sounds good.
AJ Loyacono is with the pharmacy benefit software company Truveris. He's giving a demo of his company's app, OneRx, to the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. He looks up the cost of a common antibiotic in the city.
You could see there's a wide disparity in the prices where, you know, it goes down from $20 to a high as for $61. If we look at the map, Walgreens, about 2-3 blocks away, is the lowest price.
OneRx is one of about a dozen apps that promises to help consumers get the best deals on prescription drugs. Beyond comparison shopping, the app also offers consumers retail discounts and coupons from drug makers. More than 3 million people use GoodRx, the largest of these apps, every month.
It can be a useful tool, but it's a little more squishy than what it might appear.
Lisa Gill is an editor at Consumer Reports. Gill is preaching caution after dispatching a team of secret shoppers to test the reliability of the apps.
The apps might tell you that, you know, we can guarantee these prices, but it's not a promise.
And sometimes the apps are wrong about prices. Another knock on these apps is that they promote drug maker coupons. Now, it's true. Some consumers absolutely benefit from them because it's either the coupons or go without the drug.
But it's also like a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Northwestern economist Limor Daphne says what makes coupons pernicious is that we avoid our share of a pricey drug, but the insurer still pays its share. In other words, we consumers get around the blockade insurer set up, high copays, and drug makers are off to the bank.
I assure you that pharmaceutical companies are not issuing these copay coupons because they're reducing revenues. The return on investment on these things are 4 to 6 times spending.
The real problem, says Daphne, is that coupons undermine insurers' leverage to negotiate lower prices. And the more money insurers spend this year on these expensive drugs, the higher all of our premiums will be next year. As this drug app industry takes off, it likely means a lot more coupons will be getting redeemed. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We live, as we all know, in the era of big data. Digital markers trace virtually every bit of our existence. The question is, now that we've got all that data, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to analyze it? What might it tell us? Corporations have to answer those questions. So too does the government. And the guy who's in charge of that for the government is the U.S. chief data scientist. His name is DJ Pottle. We spoke earlier this week on the sidelines of the Fast Company Innovation Festival while I was in New York. And the first question I asked him when we sat down was, how does one become a data scientist anyway?
I got this job by failing almost all my math classes.
Which point out here, you've got a PhD in applied mathematics.
I do have a point, right, but I also started my career in community college at my local community college because I failed my math class. And I took my first real math class because, as any good student does, you take the same classes that your girlfriend does. And so she took calculus. So I took the calculus class and I fell in love with it. And it was off to the races after that. But most data scientists, you have a deep technical background, but really what you're good at is working with messy, messy data. In my case, it was weather forecasting data. And it's really complex, it's yucky, and then you have to figure out what's interesting in there. And that process of iterating and working through the data is what really teaches you.
We've been collecting data for years and years and years and years and years, but it seems, and probably not to you, but to the layperson out there, it seems like we are only now recently absorbing the lessons of big data and what we can do with it. What took us so long as a society to figure this out?
One is making sure that the data people are at the table. You know, the joke that we often say is the most important thing we can learn in life is through watching Star Trek, and so there's Spock on the bridge.
Is that what data says? Is that data science humor?
That's a data science humor. It's a first generation version of Star Trek.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Spock is on the bridge. He's not in some way back office. So in the modern boardroom or in policy conversations, why isn't there a Spock in the room? Yeah. Like who helps figure out context, interpretation, all these different ideas? That shift, as people have started to put the Spock in the bridge, that said, oh, we could use data in this novel way. We could do more things with this. And then it's like, well, what more could we do from that? Oh, we could build something.
So how does this apply in government policy terms then? I mean, day in and day out, when you go to your office in, I don't know, the OEOB or wherever it is in Washington, what do you do?
Yeah. The responsibility of the chief data scientist is to responsibly unleash the power of data to benefit all Americans. So what does that look like? Number one, it says, what type of data do we have? How do we make sure that we have it? How do we secure it? How do we make sure it's safe? But then how do we turn it back to the public? And so one of those best examples is all the incredible data that's being released on data.gov. 180,000 data sets that people are using in all sorts of manners.
You understand, though, that the American public, by and large, hears government data and they think, oh, man, NSA, and they're reading my emails and monitoring my phones, and they don't see it as a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that the most important part of this is the question of what does it mean to responsibly unleash the data? And what we have to do is we have to constantly be having a conversation about what does that mean? Because there's a tremendous amount of data that we always do want the government to have. In the case of healthcare data, for example, that is data that actually benefits everybody. Like if everyone is able to have a safe way to provide their data, we're going to be able to learn so much about the type of chronic conditions that are typically undiscovered. There's all sorts of undiagnosed genetic diseases that we just can't see at this point because we don't have enough people contributing to the data.
So how big a problem is it for you in doing this job and the good that you say can come from data that the government, frankly, has a lousy history in the recent past with data, mm-hmm. with our data?
Right. The thing that I think we've seen most interesting right now is the amount of excitement that people have for this kind of projects with data. That's the thing, is when we are talking about problems that clearly benefit the American citizen, it becomes a very easy conversation. The question then is, well, in other cases, what are we collecting this data for? Why are we collecting it? Who has access to it? And what are we doing with it? Those set of conversations are the ones we need to have far greater debate and dialogue on for what its appropriate use is going to be.
DJ, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, in which somebody at Bloomingdale's somehow still doesn't get it. An ad in the 2015 Bloomie's holiday catalog goes like this. A woman looking away laughing, a man looking at her less than innocently, all with the tagline, spike your best friend's eggnog when they're not looking. Got to have people read those a couple of times, I think, huh? All righty, got to go. The Dow off 254 points today, 1.4% to the minus side. We were also minus the wah-wah trombones, I'll just note for the record. The NASDAQ subtracted 61 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 gave back 29 points, 1.4%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.